This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about the Dunes Writing Club, where published and yet to be published authors share knowledge and encouragement.
In order to be better at writing, you have to write all the time. You have to keep on writing, but you also need guidance.
Also, we'll look at how healthcare on the Central Coast is changing as a result of COVID-19.
We're seeing in the industry, hospital at home, more use of hospice, more use of palliative care. I'm hoping that that change will be permanent.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 14th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. Researchers at the University of California, Santa Barbara have made a breakthrough in using gene editing technology to create sterile male mosquitoes. And while it could fight disease, it also raises ethical and environmental questions. KCBX's Benjamin Perper has more.
That's the sound of a pair of Aedes aegypti, a species of mosquito indigenous to Africa, but now found throughout the world, including here in California. It first showed up in the Golden State in 2013, and it's spread to nearly every county in the state. That's a problem because Aedes aegypti is known as the yellow fever mosquito, and it can also spread other diseases like Zika, dengue, and chikungunya. With that in mind, researchers at UC Santa Barbara have made a breakthrough in controlling the Aedes aegypti population using gene editing technology called CRISPR-Cas9. They've used the technology to create sterile male mosquitoes that, when paired with female Aedes aegypti, render the females infertile. The researchers say that could control the mosquito's population, even crash it. I caught up with the lead scientist on the project to learn more, but first, let's take a trip through local mosquito habitat. I'm trekking through marshy land behind Chumash Park in Pismo Beach.
So there's a couple puddles that I found out.
That's
there.
Vesna Ibarra, the lead vector control technician for the Mosquito Vector Management District of Santa Barbara County. The district partners with Pismo Beach and San Luis Obispo County to treat areas like this where mosquitoes breed, places with lots of stagnant water.
It's a big circle, basically. We're tracking these critters. We're trying to target them, reduce their population, and have, you know, a nice environment for folks to enjoy, because this, you know, nuisance, it's a nuisance, but the whole concept of yet another virus in our area, that's something we're trying to eliminate.
To do that, Ibarra's team uses something they call a backpack blower. It's basically what it sounds like, a backpack-like device that blows out pesticides that kill mosquito larvae. Here's what that sounds like. Ibarra says this pesticide treatment plan, along with testing, is how the Vector Management District controls the mosquito population where they work.
So we're going to set up traps at the end of the day, also to just make a note of the population density. And if enough mosquitoes are collected, at that point we'll submit them and have them tested for West Nile virus, San Luis encephalitis, and Western equine.
But what if there were another way to control the mosquito population without using pesticides? That was the idea behind UC Santa Barbara professor Craig Montell's research into sterile insect technique, or SIT, the practice of releasing insects that can't mate with the goal of controlling their population. Montell says there's a clear reasoning behind doing this.
Mosquitoes are the most dangerous animals in the world, right?
With that in mind, and with the spread of Aedes aegypti across California, Montell set out to find a way to control the species' spread, specifically by using CRISPR gene editing technology to target a specific gene tied to fertility in male mosquitoes. If you release sterile males into the general Aedes aegypti population, Montell says, females that mate with them are themselves rendered infertile. That decreases the size of the next generation.
And the reason why that's very important is that it's the females that bite you, not the males.
Montell says this technology has the potential to reduce the spread of viruses like Zika and dengue.
There are 1 billion people, that's with a B, a billion people that get sick from mosquitoes every year. I mean, basically, we have a pandemic every single year from mosquitoes.
Chuck Dever is the president of the Mosquito and Vector Control Association of California and the general manager of the Greater Los Angeles County Vector Control District. Dever says she's in support of technologies like CRISPR-Cas9 to combat invasive species of mosquito.
We're definitely in support of new technologies just because the methodologies that we have in place are not ideal to combat Aedes aegypti. Public health pesticide products that we have are limited in their ability to deal with Aedes aegypti. There's no, there's resistance issues. They're not real susceptible to some of the chemicals that we have in our toolbox. And so we have to look at other innovative technologies. And this is just one component of our tools in the toolbox. So we want to expand that toolbox the best we can. And if that means these new technologies with SIT technology, then we absolutely welcome it.
Deborah says SIT is needed because her ground crews can't control the population of Aedes aegypti alone.
These mosquitoes are, you know, we keep calling them invasive, but at some point they're going to become endemic. They're going to settle here. They're thriving quite well in our environment, and especially with climate change. And that's kind of where the nexus is in conversations about climate change is. We now have the climate that's conducive for these mosquitoes to just live and thrive forever. So what can we do? We can, you know, enlist the sterilized male mosquitoes and, you know, try to beat them at their own game. And, you know, you do that through some of these technologies like the gene editing technology.
But Shannon Bennett, a microbiologist with the California Academy of Sciences, says this technology may not be a silver bullet.
This might be a great innovative way to scale the removal of Aedes aegypti where it's invasive, but there's a lot of other underlying problems that need to be addressed.
Problems like other species of mosquito filling the void if Aedes aegypti were to go away. Bennett says she favors a multi-pronged approach to tackling the mosquito problem in California, like
educating people to dump the water and put the infrastructure in place to not store water and to live in screened environments.
And there are other concerns raised by this technology. Dr. Charles Binkley is the director of bioethics at Santa Clara University.
CRISPR-Cas9 isn't necessarily completely perfect in the way that it works. And so there may be unintended effects in mutations on other genes. And so when you have a mutation of a gene, it can either make the gene, you can have a loss of function or a gain of function. So there are all of these things that you don't know, even in terms of the precision of CRISPR-Cas9.
Binkley also worries there could be some environmental effects to reducing or crashing the population of Aedes aegypti.
There are all of these anecdotal stories about, you know, changing something in our very tightly interrelated community, causing downstream effects that we never anticipated.
Another potential concern, Binkley says, is that we don't know if a mutation in a mosquito could cause adverse effects to humans when they bite.
When you have this intermingling between even insects and humans, particularly those that which blood is kind of the key point of contact, and you've got a mutation, then I think you do have to be somewhat thoughtful about what the effects could be.
Montel, the UCSB researcher, acknowledges the concerns behind the technology he's using. But since Aedes aegypti is not indigenous to California, he says,
in most places, it wouldn't be an environmental concern. If we can get rid of Aedes aegypti here in California, we're not messing up the environment. We're returning it to what it was in 2013 when there was no Aedes aegypti here.
As for some of the ethical concerns behind sterile insect technique, Montel says it would require public and governmental buy-in to make his plan a reality. He's not proposing letting sterile male mosquitoes loose without it. In the meantime, he says this technology is only a few years away from possible implementation on a large scale. For KCBX News, I'm Benjamin Perper.
There's an art gallery downtown San Luis Obispo you might have missed on your stroll down Higuera Street. Edna Contemporary is a fine art gallery tucked behind Basalt Interiors. As part of KCBX's Arts Beat, Lauren Wallachy talked to owner Cheryl Dane Chestnut.
Chestnut says she has been offering appointments for people to look at the artwork so she could allow some people in the gallery during pandemic shutdowns. But the opening for the new exhibit was a welcomed experience.
So getting back together with people after COVID was fabulous, but I have been lucky to be able to see people on a very limited basis.
The gallery's first opening was in March 2020, a week before the shutdowns. Chestnut says she wants to connect the gallery to the community in multiple ways, including with donations to nonprofits. But she also wants to make purchasing art a more personal experience.
Connecting to the community by bringing the artists that are really great, I mean, like super amazing artists, bringing them to the community for the opening so that the people that purchase the art are also able to meet the artists.
The current exhibit open for viewing is titled Oceans and Airstreams.
It's kind of a fun and lively, a little bit whimsical with the airstreams, and very Central Coast motivated because people are very in touch with the oceans here.
Chestnut says she wants her gallery to be a place where people can feel comfortable enjoying art.
It's kind of like wine. People go, I don't know if this is good. I mean, I like it. Art should be about what you like. It shouldn't be about what someone else is telling you is good. So we try to make it a really comfortable and casual environment.
Danielle Eubank is one of the four artists featured in the exhibit. She is an expedition artist and created a decades-long project titled One Artist, Five Oceans.
There are five oceans. So there is the Atlantic and the Pacific and the Arctic and the Southern Ocean and the Indian Ocean. And I have been able to sail them and paint them.
Eubank has painted many subjects, including trees, animals, and portraits, but says water allows her to combine many of her passions.
But I started painting water because it allowed me the freedom to create an abstract image at the same time that I could create a portrait, at the same time that I could pay homage to nature. It doesn't seem like those three things could go together very well, but they do with water.
Eubank says going on expeditions and being on a boat in the middle of the ocean is like nothing she's ever experienced.
The feeling of being on the water with no airplanes flying overhead, no other boats passing you by, at night having the stars go right down to the horizon of the water, there's nothing like that.
Her most recent voyage was an expedition to Antarctica in 2019, and she says one of the things that surprised her was all of the animals she saw.
There was a very large concentration of animals where I was. I saw lots of different whale species. I saw a couple of different dolphin species, which of course are whales. I saw lots of different birds. I saw lots of different seals, and I was surprised at just the sheer amount of animals that I saw.
Eubank says she didn't start painting water thinking it would turn into a project spanning more than 20 years.
I definitely did not think about painting all of the oceans when I started painting them. I think that I was slightly intimidated by the size of the earth. And maybe it was that point when I was sitting on the foredeck of the Borobudur ship in the middle of the Indian Ocean, where I started, you know, thinking about what my place was in this ocean, literally.
Eubank says she loves a challenge and that it was the idea that it was difficult that made her want to be an artist.
Being a fine artist and making a living as a fine artist, I had heard was one of the more difficult things that you could do. So I thought, hey, I'll do that.
Although she has been fascinated with the movement and form of water since a young age, Eubank says it was never something she thought she'd be able to capture.
I remember when I was about 12 years old, I'm from Sonoma County in Northern California, and I remember sitting on the beach looking out at the Pacific Ocean with my mom and dad, and I remember looking at the water and how it was crashing on the sand, the dark gray sand in Sonoma County, and I remember thinking, I will never be able to draw that. That is too hard. And I think I tucked that memory away, not too deeply, because I think about it all the time actually now, until I was in the bike wreck in Spain, you know, a lot of years later. And I was looking at the ocean and I was thinking, I will never be able to paint you. And then I thought, hey, hang on, that sounds like a challenge. Just because I haven't been able to paint you so far doesn't mean that I can't. And just because other people have painted you maybe in a way that I didn't, you know, care for as much, that doesn't mean I can't. That's more of a challenge. Let's find a way to paint this water and draw this water and capture it in a way that works for me.
When she paints, Eubank says the process can be scary at times.
I think it's that I'm trying to do something that I've never done before. I'm trying to push myself a little harder, push myself into what I call my own personal cutting edge. We all have our own personal cutting edge, right? That thing that is uncomfortable for you, that thing that is hard. And the closer you get to that thing, the scarier it gets. And so it can actually be kind of scary when you're creating.
Eubank says when she's in her studio painting, she can get into the zone and lose track of time.
And it's this point where you are so involved in your passion, in your work, that time and space seem to evaporate. Sometimes I will be painting and I will get into the zone, and I could have been painting for 5 minutes and I will think that, you know, 2 hours has gone by. Or sometimes I will have been painting for 2 hours and it feels like, but actually 5 minutes have gone by. So it's a very nice place to be in my studio working away.
Two of Eubanks' Antarctica paintings were recently stolen. She says her gallerist filed a police report, and any information about the stolen artwork can be sent to the San Luis Obispo Police Department. Eubanks' paintings will be featured at the Edna Contemporary Gallery through the month of June. To make an appointment to view her work, visit the website ednacontemporary.com. For KCBX News, I'm Lauren Wallachy.
The Arts Beat is made possible by a grant from the Community Foundation, San Luis Obispo County. Leaders in California's summer camp industry say that, in addition to COVID-19, racial justice movements of the past year could lead to a revamping of current camp culture. Randall White of Cap Radio reports.
Recently, while hiking with roughly a dozen young kids along a trail near Donner Lake in the Sierra Nevada, this happened.
A bug!
The kids stopped to observe a curious insect resting on a boulder.
It looks like a gray and yellow.
I think it looks like a fly.
This hike is part of a TINS Day Camp, or Tahoe Institute for Natural Science. Education manager Kendall Scott says more outings are now on the summer camp schedule, which were canceled last summer because of COVID. She says parents couldn't be happier.
We have kind of unprecedented levels of interest in camp this year. We actually opened up 2 new sections of camp. So yeah, I definitely think people are really excited.
But expanding camp operations is not the only issue on the minds of some in the camp industry. There's a new push to make this childhood tradition more inclusive of different races, cultures, and of those in the LGBTQ communities.
The considerations and the thoughts and the questioning is happening like I haven't seen it before.
Liz Kimmelman is the owner of Tumbleweed Day Camp in Los Angeles and a member of the American Camp Association.
The camp industry is slowly, but is working on creating more spaces that directly support and make safe for the non-dominant culture.
Kimmelman believes diversity, equity, and inclusion is not just about providing camp scholarships for economically disadvantaged children, but it's also about reconsidering some long-held camp traditions, like using native-sounding words and images of teepees.
Oh my goodness, we are greatly culturally appropriating indigenous iconography, and to realize that, you know, I'm acknowledging it, and we're going to do something about it.
Another important issue as children head back to these large social settings is mental health. Dr. Heather Bernstein is a clinical psychologist at the Child Mind Institute in the Bay Area. She thinks camps could use this summer's reboot to focus on the mental well-being of the kids they serve. Bernstein anticipates a lot more anxiety in campers this year and says camp staff and parents shouldn't just brush it off and instead should be
really leaning into the validation of how stressful that this might be. And it might be fun and your kid might have an awesome time, but kind of giving them the space to just talk about that it is scary and then helping them problem solve and helping them come up with strategies to live with the anxiety and still go to camp.
We want to go down to the creek.
Back with the kids on the trail near Donner Lake, camp leader Kendall Scott says learning about and being in nature are cures for some anxieties. She says spurring kids to be inquisitive about their surroundings helps them better understand and reduce fear. Which brings us back to the unusual bug spotted earlier in the hike and how I noticed the kids getting excited, not frightened by the insect. Part of that teaching method in action. In this case, the kids learned it was a type of hoverfly. Totally harmless.
Bye bye bug.
In Sacramento, I'm Randall White.
Bye.
U.S. Army Garrison Fort Hunter Liggett in southern Monterey County is on target to reach their goal of net zero energy resiliency to critical facilities by 2022 via a new microgrid. KCBX's Tom Wilmer has more.
U.S. Army Garrison Fort Hunter Liggett in southern Monterey County is on target to reach their goal of net zero energy resiliency for critical facilities by the year 2022 via a new microgrid. Hunter Liggett is on target to become the first U.S. Army installation capable of generating and distributing electricity off-grid for a minimum of 14 days. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me at Fort Hunter Liggett for a visit with Base Commander Colonel Charles Bell. Colonel Charles Bell, it's a special day on base, isn't it?
Yeah. Hey, Tom, again, thanks for coming out. We cut the ribbon on our microgrid expansion project, $21 million project. Aside from the cost, it's going to help us achieve net zero. And by that, meaning we'll hit our energy resiliency goals by 2022. And so a really significant project. Really happy to go ahead and break ground on this project with all of our partners and really start heading towards our end state of energy resiliency.
It was surprising when I first learn that Department of Defense and the U.S. Army Reserve and the Army are environmentalists. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
It is. So the nice thing about our energy resiliency goals, you know, we're actually in a net zero pilot. I don't know if you knew that. In 2010, we entered a net zero pilot as an installation. So, however, we're focused on energy today. We have projects that are really focused on helping us conserve water, helping us properly dispose of and be conservative when it comes to wastewater and all of our waste, solid waste with Sierra Natural Gas. So several projects all focused on really reducing our footprint.
I seem to recall you have a cogeneration plant at some stage of development.
Right, yeah. So that cogeneration plant is the one that we had talked about that was a DOD-sponsored project with Sierra. And so they're continuing to test that technology and, you know, we're looking for applicability. And the neat thing about that is, although it's hosted here, all the other DOD installations have come down and looked at that project. And it's a model. And there's several other installations that really look at the use and really think it's going to be applicable to their installations. I think here, in terms of our ability to apply that technology, we don't generate enough waste. But in a place like Camp Pendleton, which actually just came down to look at it, there's enough of a waste stream there to really support that technology. But getting back to our microgrid, what our microgrid is going to do, so we have an existing microgrid. I don't know if you're aware of that. We have an existing microgrid on the installation, 3 megawatt battery capability. That's enough to provide load balancing technology when we have power outages. It really doesn't support the installation. It doesn't have the capability or the strength, if you will, to support the installation. This technology here in this microgrid expansion will provide us where we need to go to provide that resiliency.
100% net zero, right?
Correct. It's 100% net zero. And when we say 100% net zero, that's 14 days of resiliency. However, with solar, as long as you have sun, you have continuous resiliency as long as you have battery storage.
That being said, that means that you're pushing energy back into the grid and helping out King City, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And so it not only helps out King City, it helps out every other partner that gets their energy from PG&E. As we continue to improve our installation readiness, and that's really what this is all about, right? When we kind of follow the path of how we're supporting the installation, this is all about supporting installation readiness, making sure that our strategic support area is available for units to train.
So that being said, taking it one step further, a primary mission and for you is to make sure base stays online in the case of a cyber terrorism attack on PG&E, correct?
Correct. And so that's a good example, right, as we look at the pipeline on the East Coast and what happened there. So this will provide that capability and allow us to continue to operate if there were to be any interruption, regardless of what it is, to electric power from PG&E. Wildland fire, as we know, the power, you know, they shut the power down if there's a high risk. You know, we've seen it all in California. We know that. And so this will just provide us that extra safeguard while allowing us also to be good stewards and conserve energy as well.
Today, if there was a PG&E outage, would the base stay online power-wise?
So, Tom, we would stay online power-wise, but not because of an efficient power method. We have diesel power generators at all of our critical infrastructure that will provide that temporary power. From a carbon footprint perspective, not where we want to be. So we have some capability, but it's not to the breadth of capability that this new expansion is going to provide.
I really appreciate you taking the time to visit.
Anytime, Tom. Thanks for coming out. I look forward to your next visit.
It's been a pleasure. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting. We've been speaking with Colonel Charles Bell at Fort Hunter Liggett in southern Monterey County.
On today's nonprofit story, you'll learn about a group of writers on the Central Coast who support and encourage each other.
This is the Nonprofit Story. I'm Dr. Consuelo Mutes, your host. The Coastal Dunes California Writers Club is an educational nonprofit corporation dedicated to educating writers from all levels of expertise in the craft of writing and marketing of their work. Judith Granera of the Coastal Dunes California Writers Club. She's with us today to tell us about the organization. Judith, welcome to the Nonprofit Story.
Thank you.
I'm excited to have people learn about the Writers Club. I've had an opportunity to listen in on some of your work. In fact, when you presented as an expert, I was able to listen in. And I'd like people to know more about the Coastal Dunes California Writers Club. So give us some background.
The local group, the organization started in 1909, and the local group started in 2014. So just about 7 years. One of the things that kind of scared me away at first was that you had to be published, was what I heard, in order to be a member of the group. And I wasn't real comfortable with that. But then I found out what their idea was behind it. You did not have to be published, but they want to have a significant percentage of published writers, so that they can support the newer writers who are coming in, which makes a lot of sense to me. So they just try and maintain that balance that they have, you know, people that are experienced. And I've certainly seen the difference in people since I've joined the club, not for me specifically, but just their participation in the group, how their writing has improved over time with speakers and individual support.
So you're a combination of those who are published and experienced and new people coming in to work together. Now, how does that happen? Do you all come together at a meeting or do you break into groups?
Things certainly have changed because of COVID. Our normal process was to meet once a month at the Nipomo Library. And because of COVID, we switched to Zoom meetings. So again, it's just a gathering. And we have probably, even during COVID, we have probably usually at least 25 people show up for the meetings, which is significant. I think it's been something that saved a lot of people's sanity. Being able to write has made a big difference for me.
I've come to a meeting and I know that you get a lot done.
The meetings are a couple hours on Saturday morning. So let's assume we're still meeting at the library. The first part of the meeting is devoted to networking. So people gather in little groups and move around and talk to people. That's what I miss so much with the Zoom. It's much harder to do that. People catch up on what they're doing and problems they're having and exchange contact information with other members so that they can, you know, get support and help that they need or offer support and help that they need. The second part of the meeting is the speaker, which is a key part. We have a speaker except for December when we do open mic and people have, I think it's about 5 minutes to read their work before the group.
I know I came in March and you actually presented on the craft of writing. And that was very interesting. Your group sounds quite educational. And looking at some of the topics you have done, there's a lot of working with the craft of writing, like memoir or character development, writing your descriptions. So it seems that you really are looking at educating people in how to write in different genres.
One of the things that the group has been very successful with is that they've published, I think it's 5 anthologies. It gives writers an opportunity to get their work published. I edited a couple of the anthologies, so I'd go through it and make suggestions if things needed to be changed and send it back. in order to be better at writing, you have to write all the time. You have to keep on writing, but you also need guidance.
Tell us about the anthology. Focus on a certain genre, or were all stories, poems, everything a part of this?
The club has been alternating. They were trying to do two a year, and thankfully they decided that was too much work. It just wasn't time, because it's all volunteer. Everybody who's doing this is doing it on a volunteer basis. So it's kind of gotten down to about one a year now, and they alternate between fiction and nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And fiction, both of them, either fiction or nonfiction, can be poetry, it can be memoir. There's no theme for it.
If you are just joining us, this is The Nonprofit Story. I'm Dr. Consuelo Mukes, your host, and I'm speaking with Judith Guanera of the Coastal Dunes California Writers Club. You really do look at a diversity of topics to help people with their writing. And you're interested in people that can come from any type of background. I even see that you're presenting on metaphysical mysteries and legal fiction, so people can listen to experts in this area.
This year, they focused on what they actually called the craft of writing. So approximately every other meeting was strictly on craft. You know, we're trying to give people's specific skills. So when they sit down to write a story, they know what the elements of a story are. They know what they need to include and how to include it and how to write to engage an audience.
And I know there's so many people that love to write. And I see that as you get ready to go back into live meetings, if possible, that you,
yeah.
you will be looking at educating writers at all levels. And so do you have mostly experienced people now, or are people who are just starting out still welcome into the group and coming into the group?
It's a nice mix of both. I would say we're constantly adding, even during the pandemic, we've continued to add new members. I think it's something like 60% published and 40% non-published. We have a lot of hopes to do more with connecting people. Recently, I had someone write a story, was going to submit it to the e-zine that we've just begun. We used to do a monthly newsletter. Now we're going to a quarterly e-zine. And I was able to connect him with a mentor, someone in the group, because he was really new at writing, but eager and anxious to be a good writer. We also recommend classes and individuals who were out there doing editing or teaching writing, trying to give as much support as possible.
So people can come in feeling that they're not behind. They can come in and feel like they're going to get support, apparently, to get published.
That's a strong focus of the group, is getting members published. Personally, I'm more interested in people becoming better writers than just in the publishing part of it. So we kind of found that place in between where we're preparing people to make them, help them be good writers so that they can be published and be proud of the work that they've, you know, that they've had published.
Let me ask, what is published? I know people talk about that a lot today. For instance, if you have your own blog on your own website, is that published, or does it have to be with a third party publisher? What is being published, and has that changed in recent years?
I think it's a pretty loose term. If you, I write columns for newsletters, so I'm published because the newsletter is published. Your comment about having a blog on internet is considered published. I think when they're looking at the breakdown in the club of published and non-published people, they're probably looking more for people who are professionally published. That's a really loose term nowadays, too, because so many people are self-publishing.
Right.
And the self-publishing can be a danger, because anybody can put a book out there. So belonging to a writing organization is a good way to kind of up your odds that what you put out there is going to be something that people really enjoy and it's well-written.
Self-publishing, I know, is just a huge thing. You have Kindle, you have the I think Creative Commons or something. No, it's not Creative Commons. It's something on Amazon. You can get a book out very easily. Is there a lack of credibility to that sometimes when you're looking at published authors and those that self-publish, or is there still a level of respect for that writing too?
At first, if you self-publish, you could almost be guaranteed that a publisher wouldn't touch you after that. But now, because people are doing things like joining writing organizations and improving their skills in writings, you can be self-published and have a publisher, you know, read your book or read an excerpt or whatever and offer you contract or express interest in your writing.
Well, I know you're an editor, so you have a chance to see writing in the raw and help writing to get to a different level. What are some of the things you've noticed as an editor with writing that might be a few tips that you could give?
Just put your story on paper, whatever it is. If you're writing an essay or you're writing a fiction story or whatever, get your work on paper. Don't worry about editing it. Don't worry about whether you're following rules or whatever. There's time for that after you're done. You can go back for that. But it kind of interferes with the creative process if you're trying to write and edit at the same time. It's really important to have your work edited. It's really important for the writer to spend considerable time editing their own work. And one of the greatest ways that I've found to edit my own work and encourage other people to do is to read it out loud. When you write something and you're spending all this time on your keyboard and the words are coming out, you begin to, your fingers begin to type the words that you think you're typing. And I'm not just talking about typos either. I'm just talking about when you read it out loud, all of a sudden you realize you've used the same word in three different paragraphs. That happens to me where a word, boy, this is a great word. I don't stop and think this is a great word, but I know it's a great word. So I keep using it. Uh-huh. And it pops up in another paragraph and another paragraph. But when I read it out loud, it's, oh my gosh. Or to have someone else read it to you also, because as you're listening to your story, you hear, oh my gosh, you know, she sounds like she's 13, but in this chapter, she sounds like she's 23. That doesn't work.
So if people wanted to become a member of the Coastal Dunes California Writers Club, how could they do that?
If you're interested in getting more information about the organization, if you contact treasure at coastaldunescwc.com.
Okay, so that's coastaldunescwc.com. And find out also about the upcoming meetings.
Most of the meetings are on the first Saturday of the month at 10:30.
And do you know if you're going to be going back live, or can we still start joining on Zoom?
At this point, joining on Zoom, we just aren't sure when the library is going to be available or if we need to find another location.
So. You've got a great lineup of speakers coming up for the rest of the year on different types of craft for the writing. And I know it's a wonderfully friendly organization that allows anybody to come in and listen and learn and not feel intimidated. So Judith, thank you so much for joining us today. I've been speaking with Judith Granera of the Coastal Dunes California Writers Club. You can find them on coastaldunescwc.com and know how to join this writers club that can help you with your craft and to get published. This is Dr. Consuelo Mutes, The Nonprofit Story.
And finally, a visit with a Central Coast healthcare leader on Working Lunch.
Hello and welcome to The Working Lunch. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the Slow Chamber, and today we'll be having a conversation with the CEO of Tenet Health Central Coast, Mark Lisa. Mark is responsible for the strategic leadership of Twin Cities Community Hospital in Templeton and Sierra Vista Regional Medical Center. Prior to his arrival on the Central Coast, Mark served as the CEO of Doctors Hospital of Manteca and as a lieutenant from the Medical Services Corps of the United States Navy. He also served in Washington, D.C. on the staff of the Navy Surgeon General. And I'm so looking forward to learning more about Mark's leadership philosophy, how healthcare is changing on the Central Coast. Mark, thanks so much for being here.
Good afternoon, James. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Well, I always like to start by learning a little bit more about how people's career path started. Can you take us back maybe to a 10 or 11 year old mark? And what was your life like and what were you interested in?
I had the fortune of growing up in a very bucolic environment in upstate New York, a little town called Oneonta, New York, which was about 22 miles from Cooperstown. My dad, by that time, was a retired Navy Chief Petty Officer. My mom was a registered nurse who worked, they both worked at our local hospital. My sister and I both joined the Navy. We both enlisted and became Navy hospital corpsmen. And I ended up staying in 20 years and she got out after three or four. You know, my mom was a registered nurse. And while I did entertain at one point going to nursing school or something else, I chose another path. I went in the military and I also went in the healthcare field in the military. So it kind of worked out.
Going maybe a bit further into your military service and maybe some of the leadership lessons you learned while in the Navy, you mentioned the concept of facing asymmetric challenges.
In the military, when we talk about an asymmetrical battlefield, we're not talking about, you know, an enemy that's exactly across a front lines and, you know, you shoot from point A to point B or the enemy is right in front of you all the time. And now, you know, we're no longer fighting Napoleonic wars. We haven't done that for, you know, more than a century now. The modern battlefield, the modern healthcare battlefield, if you think of healthcare in the pandemic as a war, you know, we not only had a direct threat of the virus, but we had other threats as well. We saw social unrest. We saw different views, different sciences, different politics, all having a play. To add to this asymmetry now, we're dealing with a certain segment of our population that doesn't believe in vaccines. Another segment doesn't believe in masks. Another segment doesn't believe Dr. Fauci. And so it's not all binary. It is, there's so many factors that we've had to address in healthcare. And again, I think resiliency, ability to innovate, leverage technologies and so forth. And really, you know, I'll add to this final thought on that. One of the best things we learn in the military and as leaders is the power of teams, you know, and, you know, you're not out there alone. You're out there with a crew, with a team, with a fantastic group of professionals.
I really love that discussion there of asymmetry, because even if you wanted to directly take on COVID, right, you still had, as a healthcare system, you had there's still other diseases, other challenges. How did you get people in? How did you do surgeries? And so that resiliency you're talking about and your team, right, on a ship with 2,000 people, right? You got to rely on others.
Let me add too, there's some collateral damage that we're seeing from the pandemic, you know, increased number of behavioral health patients, especially among our pediatric population. Also a certain segment of our citizens that are fearful of coming into our ERs and our hospitals for diagnostic studies, even ER for care and things like that. So again, we had to innovate and figure out ways to, you know, how to get to these people, how to get healthcare to them rather than expecting them to come to healthcare.
You have a pretty important title. Can you tell us a little bit about what a market CEO does? Is there a typical day and what that might look like?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, my title never impresses me, so it shouldn't impress you or anybody else. I'm just one of the worker bees. So I came here in 2012 in July to be the chief executive of Twin Cities Hospital only, and that's how I landed up living in Paso Robles, because I like to be close to where I work. As time progressed and the hospitals matured and our company, Tenet Healthcare, Tenet runs 65 hospitals and a lot of other healthcare delivery mechanisms. As things progressed and leadership changed, my vision for a long time had been, we have these two hospitals that are really complementary of each other. We shouldn't be frenemies. We should be working very closely together and we should share a lot of the leadership team and so forth. And that, for the most part, has come to fruition. So as market CEO, I'm responsible for the strategic direction of both of our hospitals, of the entities that are supported by our medical foundation, First California Physician Partners, our two urgent care centers, and our two outpatient imaging centers. So we span the county, north to south, east to west. And my role is to, you know, the strategic direction, making sure we have the people, the equipment, the things we need to do our jobs to meet the mission, and also make sure that, you know, we're appropriately ensuring that we have all of the resources that we're getting from tenant healthcare and, you know, from the government to do our jobs and to deliver that healthcare.
You talked right there about that alignment between a nonprofit medical foundation and urgent cares, the imaging, the hospitals, and bringing all that together. Has that really benefited patients across our community by bringing all those in line?
I like to think so, because we're essentially an integrated healthcare delivery system. Well, in technical parlance of healthcare administration, that means, you know, we have created and continue to refine and create a seamless healthcare delivery system where somebody can enter, you know, if you refer to it as a delivery system, somebody can enter the process maybe at one of our urgent care centers or an ER or through our tele-ER mechanism. They can enter the system there. And then if they need to come for, you know, stabilized care at one hospital and maybe go for specialized care at another hospital, it should be seamless to our patients when they enter our system for care. And, you know, quite frankly, I have to mention it. Kudos to our colleagues, you know, across town. If somebody comes in with a cardiac issue and they need direct intervention, we have transfer agreements with French Hospital Medical Center, and we share a lot of the medical staff between our hospitals. And so, you know, there's a very collegial relationship, and I would say that became even better over the pandemic, you know, working closely with my colleagues over there, Jim Malone and Julie and all of their team over there. The better we can, I call it removing transactional friction. The better we can remove the friction of doing business, the friction of going to the hospital, the registration process, and then we take the fear out of all of this by creating an environment that's safe, secure, and comfortable for our patients, the better we can do that without requiring work from our patients, the better our patients will be. They'll heal quicker, they'll feel better, and there's scientific evidence to prove that when people feel safer, secure, and comfortable, they do heal quicker. And I call it declinicalization. There's no reason why a medically clinical space, you know, there's laws and regulations, of course, but, you know, I'm really not a fan of white walls and harsh white lights. And, you know, the more we can make a comforting environment, and the government's coming around too. They're seeing things like that. CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, have are proponents now of things such as hospital at home. We worked very hard to become among the first hospitals in the country to develop a tele-ER mechanism where over this, a very similar secured platform, a patient in San Simeon or in Napomo or out on the Carrizo Plain can dial up and actually speak with a board-certified emergency physician in one of our ERs and get care. And we've discovered people that we're going to need critical intervention. And so once the doctor talked to them, they said, you know, get in here now, come to an ER. There's some things that you can do tele-ER, you know, and not physically see that patient, but we've seen both now. We've taken care of people where they live, and we've also said, hey, you know what? Let's hang up, call 911 or get in your car and get here immediately, and we'll take care of you. And that goes back to what I said about, you know, one of those asymmetrical factors of the pandemic, people fearing or felt that they couldn't come into the hospital and still be protected from infection and the virus. In fact, hospitals in America probably became the safest places to come to because we were taking, you know, a lot of precautions for visitation and screening and masking and so forth.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce's Jim D'Antona is speaking with Mark Lisa, CEO of Tenet Health Central Coast.
Over the past 15 months, obviously, we've been dealing with COVID, and you and your team have had to meet those incredible challenges. Are there changes that patients can expect into the future because of what you learned in the pandemic?
My opinion only, I can't be an official speaker on anything, but, you know, my opinion, the pandemic has permanently changed society as we know it, locally, in the state, in the country, and then internationally as well. So we're seeing some radical shift in our society. And we are also witnessing an altered pace of change in healthcare and other things. I bet in the past couple of weeks you've ordered groceries online or you've ordered food online from Grubhub or Uber Eats or one of those mechanisms. You know, healthcare is the same thing. So we're seeing that pace of change having been impacted out of necessity by the pandemic. So these things are true. Now, I believe too, on the upside, there is an upside to the pandemic where it has pushed for logical change. It's convinced our regulators, the government, science, the industry, and I'll speak healthcare specifically, it has convinced all of us collectively that there are some things that we can do better. There are some things that make sense, like tele-ER, like a clinical affiliation with University of California, San Francisco, where, you know, we have a, we call it, it's a neurological microscope where one of our neurosurgeons can actively at the time be in an intracranial procedure in our OR. They can click a button or two and talk to one of the professors at UCSF in their neurosurgery program. And that professor or that doctor can see a tumor that our neurosurgeon is looking at, and they can have an active real-time consultation. And so all of these things that we've done and we're seeing in the industry, hospital at home, more use of hospice, more use of palliative care, and so forth, I'm hoping that that change will be permanent, that the government will say, yes, this is the right thing to do. It helps de-stress people physically and emotionally. It takes the burden off of families, and that can be a permanent thing, and we're going to authorize that. So there is an upside to the pandemic, despite all of the tragic, you know, the things that, you know, the deaths that we've had, the out of school, the behavioral health crisis that it's created, there is an upside. And so, again, there's that asymmetry that we're talking about. And if we are facile enough, if we're innovative enough, if we're resilient enough, all of us together can work to leverage that upside rather than just focus on the downside. You know, it's done. There's nothing we can do to change it. What we can affect now is our present and going forward. And it's going to be so important for us as leaders, you and your team as community leaders, me and my team as leaders of healthcare in the county. It's going to be important for us to leverage that and accentuate that positive and continue to push that pace of change forward for the benefit of our communities.
You're talking about this partnership with UC San Francisco. If you could tell us how that came to be, I'm sure it wasn't an overnight piece. Like, I'm sure there was a lot of work that went into it, but it does seem like that will change how healthcare, some of the healthcare gets done right here in our community and raise that level.
Sure. Dr. Phil Kissel, who had a relationship with Dr. Mitch Berger up at UCSF, who, you know, that's a world-renowned program up there. They're nationally and internationally recognized. We had Mitch and his team come down. We ate lunch out on the patio there of the Spirit of St. Louis restaurant, and we had a really good discussion about what could be and how we would pull this off. And, you know, we determined that, you know, we were a great area for UCSF to focus on in terms of having more ability to look at the science of neurosurgery and what's happening and having a whole nother population to go into their milieu to help their studies and help their delivery of care. At the same time here, you know, let's face it, we're sort of an isolated insular community here on the Central Coast. So the very things that we relish about the Central Coast and that makes it so great to live here, it, you know, also has its drawbacks in that if you want, you know, typically if you wanted tertiary or quaternary care, you're going to drive several hours to somewhere else. And what's emotional stress, mental stress, family stress, physical stress. You shouldn't have to go anywhere if you live on the Central Coast to get great quality, advanced technical healthcare. So we talked all about this. And I think the things that took the longest were getting the lawyers to sort out, you know, what we're going to call this thing and how we're going to behave and what the billboard's going to look like. But this is a real thing. Phil Kissel, Dr. Kissel actually has an academic appointment now at UCSF, works here full time. We're going to be working with UCSF in terms of as they recruit new physicians and as we recruit new neurosurgeons to the Central Coast, there's a tie in there. And of course, the obvious real-time technical consultation and advice for our patients, which will benefit them. And, you know, as far as, you know, say, Twin Cities and patients in the North County, the patients that, you know, we have already seen direct transfers from Twin Cities to UCSF, those patients that didn't, you know, we didn't want to wait and transfer them to Sierra Vista and then transfer up. So this also has a component of if we absolutely don't have the facility or capacity here to do something for a patient, because there are some things that need a highly technical surgical suite, we will transfer those patients. So essentially, the way I put it is we've been guaranteed beds at UCSF in their Department of Neurosurgery for our patients for whom we can't take care directly down here. I can't even find the words to describe how proud I am of our professionals here and everybody that lives here. All 280,000 of us should be very proud of the healthcare leaders that we have in our county, the doctors, the nurses, all of the technicians, all of the ancillary folks, but the leaders too, the administrators who are very dedicated, get very little press time or face time, but they're every day, they're nose down. They're working very hard to make things happen. And I'm quite proud to be among them. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, I'm the face of the operation. That's not much of a thing to brag about, but I'm so excited about who I get to work with every day because that's what keeps me going.
I see a lot of hope in the long term for our community. It's important for all of us to have a strong healthcare system.
One of the mantras I learned a long time ago from one of my Navy mentors is that all of us together are better than any one of us.
And really appreciate you sharing your story, your leadership discussion that, again, helps all of us get better. So, again,
take care. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks for tuning in. Stay healthy and safe out there.
That was San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce's Jim D'Antona speaking with Mark Lisa, CEO of Tenet Health Central Coast. Tenet Health is a financial supporter of KCBX. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.